Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and it happens to be the one day that our government actually pulled the wool over our heads and has basically helped us accept, through a holiday, communism. Now, I'm going to get into that, and I'm going to get into the history because that's the standard curriculum when we have this holiday, because it's important that you understand the intent behind having a, quote-unquote, Labor Day. Just remember this, that the Labor Party throughout the world is called the Communist Party. The Labor Party in the United States is called the Democratic Party. And this being an election year, be advised what party you're supporting. And I can't think of anybody listening to this other than, you know, my arch enemies, as if I'm a superhero, that are out there listening to the show trying to find ways to defeat and foil our plans in taking back the Republic. But anyhow, the other thing I need to say, because if it bleeds, it leads, or if it's one thing that affects your wallet, you may actually pay attention. That debt that everybody says we owe is fraud. The money that they keep printing is all being done fraudulently. They don't have the authority to spend money on just anything they want. So keep in mind, when they're ready to collapse our economic system, they're doing so because they fraudulently created this facade that we actually owe that money. We don't owe that money, folks. Just because they're getting away with printing and spending because we're not stopping them, the people that are taking are giving us and creating the debt so that they can spend that money, they're equally culpable. They have equal responsibility to ensure that the money they're granting is actually a legally binding obligation on the nation. It's not. So just keep in mind that when it comes down to it, when the world wants their pound of flesh, we will send them the Obamas and Pelosis and all of the people that have been responsible. Even Trump, because he's been responsible too. Now, that's if the world wants him. But the point is this, folks. There is a responsibility when you take office, and you have to support the Constitution. When you sign a check or you demand that we pay for something that we have no authority to pay for, that person is actually committing fraud. And so there's no point in forgiving. As a matter of fact, I had no intention of bashing Trump. It just dynamically came up. Because the reality is, every president that we've had, even Reagan, spent money on things that were unconstitutional. Because at that point, we all just accepted this is how it's done. And it is not done that way. They have just embraced I'll just call it, because this is what I call it, folks. Most people would say this fraudulent government is a house of cards. It is so massive. They've done so many things that they had no authority to do, and everything that they've done that has been harmful to us and putting us in harm's way, they had no authority to do. They have no authority to be waging warfare and spending money on spraying us and spending money on CO2 pipelines or spending money on social engineering, any of these engineering feats that they're actually getting away with, they don't have any authority to do it. So keep in mind that when push comes to shove, the people you need to be poking in the eye are your state legislators. They are the ones that actually have the constitutional and legal obligation in keeping that federal government in check. And if they don't stand up and tell the federal government, you don't have the authority to put aside our Constitution. And we're going to get into that a little bit. But what I really want to dive into, because over this weekend, as you know, had to do a few chores and had to actually listen to news, because I try not to get in, you know, I just feel dirty when I start swimming in the news or when I hear some news. But as it started playing, actually wasn't today, it was yesterday or the other day. As it started playing and I was hearing this intent that the Schumer and the Senate, they have the votes to take it to 50% plus one. All they need are 50 votes and Kamala Harris will basically take it over the line. I'm telling you, folks, they don't have that authority to vote on things that the state legislators do not want them to do. Now, one of the things that I haven't done the due diligence on, because I'm actually going to go through this, because there's no doubt in my mind, there are Democratic senators that are vulnerable. There are Democratic senators in the Senate that can be pulled back quickly, because they actually come from and represent a red state. And that state legislature could literally force them to come back and face charges for violating the state legislature's right of suffrage. In other words, they'd be recalled by the state legislature just because they're chosen, just because they are chosen by the people of the 17th, because the 17th Amendment changed the manner and how they were to be appointed. But that did not change their responsibility. The one thing you look at, we covered this in detail, but when you look at the 17th Amendment, the 17th Amendment did not touch Article 5. And Article 5 still lays the requirement of what each senator is supposed to do, who they are supposed to represent, whose suffrage they are supposed to offer on that Senate floor, as well as in their votes and everything that they do. And if the state legislatures feel like they're not getting their suffrage, then they have every right to pull them back like that. I mean, I wanted to make sure that snap wasn't overbearing. So this is what it says, provided that, because in Article 5 is the amendment process in the Constitution. And so they give you this process of the two paths of amending the Constitution, one via the Congress path, where Congress actually submits. Well, actually, they work out an amendment and they get both houses to pass it with 2/3 majority. And then they send that out to the states for ratification. The other path is where 2/3 of the states petition Congress to hold a convention. And then Congress will take control and actually hold that convention. And what I mean by that is all things arising under this Constitution do fall under the jurisdiction of the federal government. However, when it comes to this next line, provided, this is the second half of Article 5, provided that no amendment which shall be made, that no state, I'm just actually putting a dot there because it has, provided that no amendment which shall be made prior to the year 1808 shall in any manner affect the first and fourth clauses in the ninth section of the first article. So that one is identifying that they can't create an amendment to take away the ending of the slave trade. And then the next part, the second clause, the second amendment that cannot be made is that no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. Now, I'm telling you, all you have to do is have the attorney generals of these states actually charge these men for violating the suffrage of the state legislature and pull them back on recall, because no state shall have this denied. And when we look at what Schumer is trying to get away with, and just saying, we're going to do whatever we want. We're going to restructure the Supreme Court. We're going to do all of these things. Not if you've got a senator that's representing a state that doesn't buy into this uncontrolled, out of control, bat crap crazy Senate move that Schumer is trying to push, this agenda. Folks, we've been talking about citizenship, and we've actually helped you understand, because I've said this before, that there is a legal obligation and a standard that must be maintained if you want to be a citizen. You have to earn your citizenship every day with every deed. You decide to actually commit an insurrection against the Constitution. You decide to support things that are not constitutional, such as Sharia law, such as trying to inflict laws and bills of punishment and anything that is unconstitutional, then we have the right. And actually, the right exists within your state. Your state legislature has the authority to strike people's citizenship. Imagine this. Imagine where we would be as a nation had the states actually maintained cognizance in understanding the importance of citizenship. So, placing context to this, because we, you know, it's important that we do that. When we actually look at the requirement of a citizen and what they're supposed to do, they are supposed to, they can be legally compelled to take up arms to support and defend the Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic, which means that when somebody's actually doing something that is contrary to the Constitution, you should actually be speaking up. In the old days, if you committed a crime, just a crime, you could lose your right to citizenship. You could have that revoked. And as a matter of fact, once a state revoked that citizenship from the state, the federal government revokes your citizenship as well, because they actually don't even manage that type of stuff. And as a matter of fact, when a state actually places on a list, these people cannot be citizens, and they decide to move somewhere else in the republic, you know, such as let's say South Carolina. South Carolina has this list of people that cannot be citizens of that state. Then the United States' hands are tied, because when that citizen moves to New York, Massachusetts, or anywhere else, and they apply to be a citizen of that state, that doesn't mean that they become a citizen of the United States. The United States has to ensure that all citizens are equally recognized in all states. And if a state says you can't be a citizen, because there's this thing called reciprocity, you have a right to travel around. Once you become a citizen of one state, those rights that come under the Constitution, when you're worthy to become a citizen of the United States, this means that you can travel freely amongst the states. But if a state basically says you can't be a citizen and you're banished from this state, then the federal government cannot overpower the sovereignty of a state. So how does this play? Well, it just takes a quick phone call for the state legislature to actually order the governor to have the attorney general charge for treason against the state that senator and use Article 4. And we talked about this before, and I've come up with, you know, well where does that go? Where is that where a person can actually become, you know, pulled back? And it is in Article 4, Section 2. It's the second paragraph. A person charged in any state with treason, felony, or other crime who shall flee from justice and be found in another state, like a senator sitting in the District of Columbia. See, they're actually talking about, and folks, you have to understand the ramifications of this. They're talking about creating statehood for the District of Columbia. They can't do it. They can't do it. The way it was defined is that was to be an autonomous body, not to be a state, so that it couldn't be subjected to the sovereignty and the control of a state. The child is trying to elevate itself into equal status of the parent, and they can't do it. It was designed as the best security to ensure that, one, it would be unfettered, that it could do its job in serving all the states, but instead it wants to serve itself now. What they have been doing over time, and actually I think we need to actually create a petition for this, but we are working on a petition against Kamala Harris. And it is, the abstract is ready. If you're ready to start getting a petition out to basically challenge the fact that she cannot be, and she has not been eligible to serve as the vice president or serve as any executive, an elected executive in the United States government. She cannot. As a matter of fact, there's no evidence. I have no evidence that she's actually legitimately become a citizen. So putting all that aside, she's not a natural born citizen, and that's what the focus of the petition is. You must be a natural born citizen, and this is why we're covering these things. So anyway, so when the legislature basically goes to the governor to tell, and actually they order the governor to recall this the senator for violating their suffrage, that they have a right for suffrage and they're being ignored by their senator, then they, because they could just charge him with a crime, bring that person back, then the governor will replace that person, because that's what the 17th Amendment does. They will replace that former senator with somebody else for the interim, and that person that goes will understand that they will carry that line. They're going to actually serve the state legislature. So folks, don't worry about, you know, the stupid stuff. The Constitution was written by somebody that was far wiser than you or I, because there's no doubt in my mind, only he knew what we would be facing in these times. And he's given us everything that we need. All we need to do is really start to understand. It's not that difficult. And I may be marginalizing, but it is really not that difficult. Once you start understanding, you know, what the Constitution is and who the parties are to it and who has the ultimate say and authority, then it actually becomes, you know, self-evident. Now, we're going to be having Tammy Young start tomorrow covering some of this content. We're going to be covering content as this nation evolved after the ratification of the Constitution. And so the first thing we're really going to dive into is I'm going to give you the evidence regarding the Federalist Papers and how it enabled the federal courts to get away with stating, because we said so. That's right, court. The courts and the jurists basically said, we say so because we have the ability to interpret and create law. They aggrandized themselves, and the mechanism of doing that was the Federalist Papers, because they ignored the actual terms and conditions of the compact as established by the parties to the compact. And now we actually have lawyers, and we have people that claim to be constitutionalists and supporting the Constitution out there. You know, there's this blogger that, you know, actually, you know, uses a part of the pseudonym of Publius. And I'm just telling you, folks, that anybody that tells you the Federalist Papers are the hands-down only way to understand the Constitution, we're going to prove to you right there in the initial debates in Congress how Madison said we must use the ratification debates. And why did the jurists actually pick up the Federalist Papers? Because Hamilton did some really dirty deeds, and you're going to love it. We're going to cover that tomorrow. But the reality, folks, is, and I've said this before, the states are the only ones with the authority, the ultimate say. They are the final. This actually comes out in so many different ways for Madison and Jefferson and in other contexts as well. So the reality is the only entity that has the authority are the states. And then actually, when they say something, they have the authority to say, because we said so. If you understand that, you know, tyranny, you know, there's lots of times when people, you know, get away with an autocratic society. But when it comes down to the law and the application of the law and what you're supposed to do, those who have the superior, the parties of the compact, the superior position in the compact, they exercise and can and will and must exercise their powers, or we will surely perish. So when we look at federal government contracts, I mean, they're very quick to exercise their power and authority. So anyway, let me just dive into what we want to cover today, because today happens to be Labor Day. And as you know, it is Communist Day, and there is the history and the information that is necessary to cover. But the one thing that I want to tie together is that when they were coming forward with Labor Day, they also came forward with a song, and there was this intent behind all of this called Fanfare for the Common Man. And the intent behind this was to create a majestic piece of music that would give people the ability, just the strength of being able to collectivize and embrace collectivism. That's why Fanfare for the Common Man was written. And as a matter of fact, Fanfare for the Common Man is a musical work by the American composer Aaron Copland. It was written in response to the U.S. entry into World War II and was inspired in part by a famous 1942 speech where Vice President Henry A. Wallace proclaimed the dawning of the century of the common man. These guys were communists that were sitting in the Oval Office, and we've had communists sitting in the Oval Office since. We've had some aberrations, you know, where people kind of deviated, outliers, but they all have been bred and educated in the communist education system that was established at the end of the 1800s. Copland considered several titles, including Fanfare for a Solemn Ceremony and Fanfare for Four Freedoms. The Four Freedoms actually were articulated by Franklin Delano Roosevelt on Monday, January 6, 1941. In an address, this is before Pearl Harbor, in an address known as the Four Freedoms Speech, technically, this was the State of the Union back then, he proposed four fundamental freedoms that people everywhere in the world ought to enjoy. Freedom of speech, freedom of worship, freedom of want, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. These last two freedoms have no, in our government, they have no place. Because government is not to be your security. You have a right to be afraid. And as a matter of fact, fear is one of the best motivators of helping you mitigate things so that you can alleviate your fear. But to think government is going to be, you know, actually remove your fear or your wants, in other words, they will supply you with what you need, is literally sending a message that you are weak and you need government. And actually, we don't need government to give us things. We only need government to serve us in two objects. And this is how our nation was framed. Those two objects were to protect life and to protect private property. Everything else was left to you. You know, if you lost your private property from somebody else based on your own stupidity, then there you go. You were a victim of yourself or a victim of others. And if there's a crime committed, then you have justice. But you have the right to be insulted, and you have the right to insult others as long as you do not assault them with battery. You know, there's assault and battery, right? Assault is actually the threat or the, you know, stating, I'm going to hit you. That's assault. Battery is when you actually lay your hands upon somebody. So assault and battery are literally two different things. And so we're going into break. When we come back, I'm going to kind of finish this history behind Labor Day, and then we're going to dive into a little bit more of what you, now that you know what you need to know, what should you really be doing right now? So we'll be right back after this short promo. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so getting back to FDR and the creation of Labor Day, in context, he summarized the values as he gave this Four Freedoms speech. He summarized the values of democracy behind the bipartisan consensus on international involvement that existed at the time. A famous quote from that speech prefaces those values. Quote, "As men do not live by bread alone, they do not fight by armaments alone." In the second half of the speech, he lists the benefits of democracy, which include economic opportunity, employment, social security, and the promise of, quote, "adequate health care," close quote. The first two freedoms of speech and religion are protected by the First Amendment of the Constitution. His inclusion of the latter two freedoms, freedom from want and freedom from fear, went beyond the traditional constitutional values protected by the U.S. Bill of Rights. Roosevelt endorsed a broader human right to economic security and anticipated what would become known decades later as the human security paradigm in studies of economic development. He also included the freedom from fear against national aggression and took it to the United Nations, which he was setting up. The majestic piece of music was written to stir American society to embrace global democracy and the governance of mankind under a new global government. Now, Labor Day, more than 80 other countries celebrate International Workers' Day on May 1st, the European holiday of May Day. May Day was chosen by the Second International of Socialist and Communist Parties to commemorate the general labor strike in the United States and events leading to the Haymarket Affair, which occurred in Chicago on May 1st and May 4th, 1886. Beginning in the late 19th century, as the trade union and labor movements grew, diverse groups of trade unionists chose a variety of days to which to celebrate labor. In the United States, a September holiday called Labor Day was first proposed in the early 1880s. Remember now, in the early 1880s, this is when the Fabian Society came to America. This is where they infiltrated our education system, but communism came to America much earlier. As a matter of fact, there was a gentleman, he was a scholar. This is in my first book. I identified George Fitzhugh. George Fitzhugh basically felt that everybody should be enslaved, but because as a slave, you're going to be taken care of better. And the more compassionate, you know, your owner is, the better off you're going to be. Because most people are just too stupid to take care of themselves. And that was the paradigm of the intellectual society in those days. This is why Karl Marx really truly believed that all labor was equal. I mean, he completely marginalized the advanced sciences and so forth to where a person that swept the floor was equal to today a person that actually performs surgery, or a person that is capable of putting a person on another planet, or a person that's capable of bending, you know, time or what. I mean, seriously? So anyway, there were all sorts of different events, and beginning again in the late century of the 1900s, this is when they started planning this. So in America, they actually started looking as a September holiday for Labor Day. Alternate accounts of the event's origins exist. Descendants of two men with similar last names claimed their great-grandfather was the true father of the holiday. According to one early history of Labor Day, descendants of two men basically came forward and tried to push this idea, supposedly. And the event originated in connection with a general assembly of the Knights of Labor convened in New York City on September 1882. In connection with this clandestine Knights assembly, a public parade of various labor organizations was held on September 5th under the auspices of the Central Labor Union of New York. The popularity of the event spread across the country. In 1887, Oregon became the first state of the United States to make Labor Day an official public holiday. By 1894, 30 U.S. states were already officially celebrating Labor Day. Now, I'm going to tell you, folks, that the Pacific Northwest, because Seattle, or I should say Washington State, Oregon, they're so far left because they were left alone. This is where these communists actually came and roosted. Unfortunately, or interestingly enough, they started actually realizing some of the failures and the fallacies because they were left to their own demise, and they realized that in some ways that this was a utopian concept, unattainable. So some of these men actually abandoned and actually started looking, which is one of the reasons why there had been, I'll just say, a wake up. And as a matter of fact, Jonah Goldberg, in his book, Totalitarianism, Fascism, I'll have to look up the book again, but I can see the cover. It's a red cover with a yellow smiley face. And in that book, he talks about how the labor unions had basically created such a problem in Seattle that they ended up putting, you know, automatic weapon mounts into the streets so that if anybody was going to come out and actually protest or what have you, they'd just shoot you down. I mean, they became so intolerant of this, the Karens that the communists were. And so it actually backfired because it built and built to a point where people said, you know what, we can't get anything done. So anyway, 30 states were already celebrating Labor Day. And that year, in 1894, Congress passed a bill recognizing the first Monday of September as Labor Day and making it an official holiday. See, this is just basically showing you how early America and the world was being infected by this disease called communism. This goes down to the real history of what happened in 1776. In 1776, when the Declaration of Independence was penned, and The Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith was written in creating a free market concept for the world. Basically, The Wealth of Nations became the Bible for the American market in creating a free market system. But at the same time, in 1776, Adam Weishaupt wrote his charter for the Illuminati and how they would function and how they would operate. And it was identified by Sir John Robinson that in his A Proofs of a Conspiracy to Destroy the Religions and Governments of Europe. And in that book in 1796, I believe, and it's actually on my website, reclaimingtherepublic.org. I think it's on either the Constitutional Articles page or at least on the Red State Talk Radio podcast page, one of those two. And eventually we'll move all of these things onto a source document page where we have books and there where we have all documents and so forth. And so when you start analyzing what had happened in 1776, the first nation that was actually touched by this evil concept of the Illuminati was France with the French Revolution, because the French Revolution originated in the communes, where people were so poor they had to collectively live together and basically started embracing collectivism. This is what helped Marx start to see the power of collectivism as a contrast to the noble kings and or the forms of monarchical governments. You got to remember that even though the United States had and established a completely different form of government, no one in the world understood this. As a matter of fact, too many people in the United States really didn't understand it, but they benefited and they appreciated, you know, its uniquenesses, some of its uniquenesses, but they didn't see the big picture. Karl Marx ignored the big picture because he wanted to create a challenge to the old paradigms. And actually what he did was he created not a challenge to the old paradigm, but a galvanizing of creating a new age of kings and queens, where these would be actually evil people that would do anything and everything because they have that control. Folks, when you look at the times, when you look at really what we're facing as a world and as a nation, we're being poisoned. They're converting our food. They're doing all of these things, and they're setting us up to kill us. They don't care. There are too many people to control. They got to cull the herd to a manageable number, which is why the Georgia Guidestones in the 1900s literally laid out what they believed was a manageable number was a half a billion, 500 million people. Now, they're not going to get that far down, but go read the Revelations. Revelations basically states 2/3 of the earth will die from pestilence, wars, all these different calamities. And all of these things will be used to cull the herd. So anyway, as we kind of go back into the context here. So by 1834, again, the United States were already doing this, and Congress passed a bill recognizing the 1st of September as Labor Day and making it an official federal holiday. President Grover Cleveland signed the bill. Now, you do realize that the federal government has no authority to create national holidays. They can suggest a time of fast and a time of prayer and humility, those types of things, but they cannot tell the states they have to stand down. That has never been a power delegated to them. But look at the power they wield today. So the federal law, however, only made it a holiday for federal workers. As late as the 1930s, unions were encouraging workers to strike to make sure that they got the day off. All United States and the District of Columbia and the United States territories have subsequently made Labor Day a statutory holiday. Labor Day became a federal holiday shortly after the Pullman strike of 1894, killing likely 30 people. Pullman, Washington. And it killing 30 people, but the information regarding that has been suppressed to glorify collective labor and hide the compulsion, coercion, and deadly forces of collective labor and mob rule. Just remember this. The ends justify the means. So when you're looking at this concept of, you know, do we allow ourselves to become subjects to, or are we going to actually be accountable to ourselves and self-sufficient? Are we going to be dependent for our security because of our fears, because of our wants? Or are we going to say, bring it on, I will do everything I can, and I will laugh in the face of danger as I provide for myself? Folks, this is a contrast of good and evil. The evil is, take care of me. I will do whatever you want. I am your subject. The good, the righteous, stand on their own. They provide for themselves, and they do what is necessary. They actually work to survive. We have created a lazy, dull, fearful world that has actually given up and wants to be taken care of. And those who are in the positions in the corporations, which is our new league of monarchies, as we look at those who command the money and the controls of money, are controlling everything else. And so what we see as the kings and those who govern us, they are the puppets that are allowed. They're allowed to be in front of us. If for some reason those who control us aren't happy, boom, that person's gone. And it's all about getting us to get to a point where we have what we need or what they need to actually succeed, because that's all they're doing. They're getting us to a point of debt. They're getting us to a point of bad health. They're getting us to a point to where it won't take much to push us off the ledge, because we've come to the ledge willingly. We have to wake up and we actually have to start moving in their face and charging them. And so this really helps go back to what we need to know, because you already understand we're supposed to have a Republican form of government, one that's unlike any Republican form of government in the world. We have a Republican form of government where our sovereigns are represented. We, the people, institute our government, and the only government we truly institute is our local government. Once we go beyond our local government works with the other local governments within the territory or the state, and they create that state government. That's the new sovereign. And every time we create a government, we ensure that we, the people, have representation there, as well as the sovereign has representation, which is why at the state level, we had bicameral legislative bodies. The Senate would represent the county, and the people were represented in the House. And at the federal level, the same thing. The Senate was representing the states, and they still are, as I started this show off, as I proved to you that their suffrage is galvanized in the Constitution right there in Article 5. They cannot lose their suffrage without their consent. If a senator chooses to go down a path that they want to actually inflict, you know, changes, unconstitutional government, or actually, you know, attack us by attacking our Constitution and seizing more and more of our controls and our sovereignties away from us without the real authority to do so, then the state legislatures must respond. They must act. This is why you need to start getting involved. Again, you already know what we need to know. You have representatives, and that is who is accountable to you. The courts are not accountable to you. The courts have aggrandized themselves to a point where they're controlling us. They don't have the authority in the Constitution to do the things that they do. The same thing with the executive. The executive is not our king. He is supposed to execute the laws. That's it. The limited and defined laws that are pursuant to the Constitution, not any law that Congress wants to make up. And I'm telling you, we actually have tyrants and despots. America has become so evil and tyrannical, just like the rest of the world. And it was never supposed to happen as long as we did what we were supposed to do. We had the responsibility of keeping our government in check. We had to keep our local government in check, our state government, and our federal government. And now, when you really look, everybody realizes that their local government is completely out of control. They don't listen to you anymore. They're listening to the courts. They're listening to the lawyers. They're listening to everybody but you. And these are the people that actually you have the greatest control over, because you make and break them every election day. And if you're not getting people in at the local level who are truly supporting you and reforming government and taking back this republic, then you're missing your opportunity. And I guess we are due our comeuppance. In other words, the day's coming when either we do what we have to do and actually start cutting back all this government and start actually working together and pulling together, because we willingly do that instead of having government basically take care of us because we're their subjects. So what we really need to do is we actually need to start doing one thing. The one thing that you have, the one thing that is the mechanism of taking government back, is interposition. Interposition is an act of seizing, an act of basically saying stop, halt, and using whatever force necessary. Now, in politics, we do not, because we have the Constitution, we do not need to use deadly force. It will actually get results in one day, but it won't actually get the results we need. We can't use an armed revolution. We have to use our petitions, and we have to use petitions to call them out. We have to actually create a movement. This is not that hard, folks. When people start realizing what the truth is, how they don't have these authorities, that these authorities were actually never granted them, these have all been unconstitutionally assumed, that's when people will say enough. Now, there will be people that will want to actually cut to the chase, go get guns, and go after these people. No. You have to get them to either step down or you need to replace them. So one of the most important things you need to be doing right now is you need to have and identify by November who is it that's going to be, or create a pool, you know, a group of bodies to say, okay, one of us is going to become the next two commissioners in our county to challenge these chumps. And over the next 2-4 years or what have you, we're all preparing ourselves to actually take over. And we are going to enforce the Constitution, and we're going to actually get the other counties in this state to go along. Because why? The people actually want this. The people, as much as they may like this little object or this little object that they get, everybody is realizing, because they can't afford to eat anymore, and this is all being done at neck break speed, which is why people will start getting this, and it will quickly happen, because it just takes, once we realize what we've been doing wrong by allowing these people who want to be little mini tyrants in your county, because that's what they are. They're little tyrants. They believe there are princes and princesses, that they can rule us because we're their subjects. We made the mistake of electing them. We can actually bond together and recall them if necessary. And when we do that, we need to make sure that they're replaced with somebody that's supposed to do what they're going to do, or I should say that's willing to do what they're supposed to do that we demand that they do. And when we start holding everybody accountable, then the game changes. As I've said before, we have more than enough. We have all of the wisdom of heaven in our Constitution. He has given us everything we need, from the legally binding oath that they must take to support the Constitution, to the petition for the redress of grievances, to petitioning government. When we say petitioning our government, that means our representatives. if our government is Republican in form, then why would you petition the court? Why would you petition the executive? Because he's your king? No. We have representatives. You petition your representative. I hear people all the time tell me, oh, we've petitioned, they just don't work. And I look at their petitions. They never once petitioned their representatives. They never understood what they needed to do. Nine times out of ten, they're either petitioning executives or who they think are the sheriffs or the people in charge. They're not representatives. And they can't take the government back. Your representatives have that authority. They have the authority of making law and rejecting law and getting rid of law and actually getting rid of people. They have more authority than you're even aware of. This is why when we look at all of the things that they did, how the courts have basically placed these things upon us, getting rid of common law and all of these things, because they did it without the authority. The only entity that had the authority to get rid of common law are your state legislators, and they never formally did it. Now that that cat's out of the bag, it's just going to be a matter of time. A couple of states start passing legislation in basically dismantling and getting rid of common law and recognizing civil law, admiralty law, and all of the bar association laws that they want to inflict upon you. Folks, we can start working smarter. And we have to get organized. And you can do this. So what we're going to do as we do Feedback Fridays and so forth, because one of the things I've got to do, we've got just 2-3 weeks away from Constitution Day, which means that's when we're going to start reading the Constitution. And we're going to try to get through that because there's a lot of things I need to get through before the end of the year. So we're kind of going to just go through this basically, or maybe what we'll do is actually maintain content and actually repost Paul and my coverage. And that's what we just go through this kind of at a high level with Tammy and then play or post, I should say, Paul and my conversations, because going through the Organic Act, going through some of the important amendments, some of the things that absolutely need to be gone through before the end of the year, before we start all over again, I think we need to start doubling up. So we'll probably start doubling up more of the podcast. So folks, you're going to have to actually listen to more. If you want to understand the Constitution, Paul and I will go through this by just rebroadcasting last year's shows. And what we'll do in tandem to that is what you'll actually hear. So you'll actually have to go to the podcast page to go through the Constitution in more details. But what we will do, and hopefully Tammy and others, we're going to be able to dive into some of the new content that we've never covered before. We need to get this material out to you so that as we read this, you can hear for yourself how they did it. We're going to show you tomorrow how the courts have used the Federalist Papers and how Hamilton undermined the Constitution by manipulating the Federalist Papers the way he did. And with that, folks, I hope you had a happy Labor Day, because this show airs towards the end of the day. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.